second hour of our forum. Folks? Hello? Hello? Okay, we're going ahead with the second group of speakers for our second hour. This is a fluid meeting, so feel free to come and go as you see fit. I'm going to be here for the full 3 hours, but I don't think all of you will, and that's not necessary either. It's great that you showed up. It's great that you speak. It's great that you express yourself, ask questions. As we heard from Doug, there are many different types of contingents, and they range from what we call hobbyists, so people who just like the fact that they can interact, get out of the home every Thursday evening, get away from the wife and kids, even though they have a $300,000 a year job as an attorney or school superintendent or lawyer or whatnot. It's fun to teach. So those are the hobbyists. We have retirees like myself, like Carol Rietzma, who's here, who's a retired professor of biology and teaches because she loves it. And we also have people who are trying to make a living teaching, and it's pretty hard to make a living teaching if you can only teach two courses, which comes to about $12,000 a year. So they try to teach more courses. If they can't teach more here, they'll teach somewhere else. Some have full-time jobs. Some are hoping to get a tenure track job here or elsewhere. So there's a broad diversity of people in the contingent pool. Nationally, there are about 1 million contingents, and they also include graduate teaching assistants. And I think later in this hour, or maybe next hour, we will have a representative of the Graduate Student Employees Union who's going to be here from Binghamton and talk about their perspective. So the next speaker on my list is Gauri Parameswaran. She's the chair of educational studies, and I welcome her here. If you happen to have typed versions of your statement, and I know that Andrea Noel did, and I know that Beth did, and maybe Gauri does as well, if you could send those to me electronically, that would be helpful in the transcription. You may have ad-libbed or whatnot, but we'll probably have an intern or somebody spend many hours with headphones trying to transcribe this, and so having a written statement is useful. You might also mention to your colleagues who couldn't make it here today, who wanted to speak or wanted to participate, that we will accept written statements. So I've already gotten statements from a variety of people who couldn't be here, and so spread the word. We'd like to make the record as full and complete as possible before we put it all up on the web. Okay, Gauri.
Well, some of you know I'm Gauri Parameswaran, Chair of Ed Studies, and again, like Andrea with Elementary Ed, we have a large number of both supervisors and part-time faculty who teach in our department. So, and I've been chair for 8 years, so I've got to see them work, and I've grown to appreciate their dedication. I remember last winter, one of our adjuncts was driving from Albany to teach her class during a snowstorm. Her car slid off the highway, and she did not have a way to inform her students about her class cancellation. A few students complained, and she had to face the kind of questions that full-time faculty do not get asked. And I really, at that point, got to appreciate the kind of precarious situation that many of our adjunct faculty work under. This is the life of an adjunct. Over the years, I've got to appreciate deeply the dedication that part-time faculty demonstrate towards their students and be deeply humbled by their hard work for so little pay. In fact, some of our part-time faculty have gone on to become full-time members of our department because they were just so wonderful, we couldn't let them go, and when there was an opportunity, we hired them. But those are the rare instances, but I do know so many more of them deserve to be full-time faculty members here. This was hence my decision to speak on their behalf. I know we've had several speakers here talk about better wages and benefits for adjunct faculty. I and my department support all of those endeavors. We've talked about it many, many times at department meetings and have wanted to support this. Most of them are not here because they're busy. This is a very busy time of the year. They're all grading. But I can tell you, I can speak on their behalf and say we all support that move. I would also like, in addition, to speak to other concerns that we need to be addressing as well. In our department, because of several contractual obligations, we often wait until the last moment to hire adjuncts because we do not want to deprive full-time faculty members of classes that they may need to fulfill their work obligations. Often part-time faculty contracts are renewed every semester and they are added to the payroll at the very last moment. This not only creates enormous bottlenecks for payroll, but it also creates serious issues for adjuncts also. Part-time faculty often do not receive their paychecks until halfway through the semester. If you're a chair and you're sitting here, you probably recognize, you know, you have all those desperate calls that part-time faculty members make, you know, not having received their paycheck and not knowing how to support themselves. It is hard to visualize how they are living as they wait and push for their paychecks to be delivered to them. Many have confessed that they live off friends and relatives and sometimes even have to move in with other people. When they do get their paychecks, it is delivered as a bulk amount, and this often, and therefore as a consequence of that, they lose all kinds of needs-based resources because of the bump in their salary. So that's another unforeseen consequence of all of the contractual decisions that we make here at the department, at the university. With all of the increasing assessments, I can tell you many of our part-time faculty members have to engage in invisible work for which they are not compensated for. In my school, we are going through our accreditation process, and part-time faculty members are an integral and vital part of the process. They are required to submit their general ed assessment plans, their ed TPA assessments, and accreditation assessment plans, and coordinate with full-time faculty members in order to make sure our students are fulfilling their assessment requirements. This requires them to attend meetings and use all of their creative energies. Many of them will never see the result of their efforts in the form of increased paychecks, salary increases, et cetera, or even recognition of their efforts. So this is another real vacuum in sort of the professional fulfillment for part-time faculty members. Hence, I would like to join the chorus of other voices here to reiterate that part-time faculty members need a living wage if our universities are to survive and do their jobs effectively. It is time for us to correct our past injustices and attempt to create a campus climate that is inclusive of all workers who work within its walls. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Gowrie?
I'm sorry.
Thank you all for your patience.
Thank you, Gowrie.
Let me just go through the speakers I have on my list for this next hour to make sure we got everybody. We got Donna Flahan, Yvonne Espengren, Bob Miller, who's not here yet, but we do have Vinny Martucci, so I'll put him here. Clinton Bennett and Stephanie Nystrom. I don't think Stephanie is here, but I do see Rachel Rigolino, who I had from the first segment. So we'll let Rachel get settled, maybe grab a bite to eat. There's some lox and bagels and stuff back there. So I will go in the following order, maybe have Donna and then Yvonne and then Rachel and then Bob Miller, Clinton and Stephanie. So, Donna Flahan is an associate professor in the Department of Communication and Media. And she is our recently, this year, elected vice president for academics. And so, Donna.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just wanted to address two major issues. The first issue related to part-time employment. I absolutely agree with all the salary discussions, the 5K, so I don't want to address it on that front, but on the timing and the last minute canceling of classes and how that really hurts our ability to well, it hurts the part-timers, obviously, but it hurts our ability to let students know what classes actually exist and don't exist, and how from the college's administration perspective, it would be a very small amount of money to make sure that we retain excellent part-time faculty, and also that students get their classes in time to graduate. The Communication and Media Department has, I think it's about 500 majors within the different areas within the department. I teach specifically in the public relations concentration. And we have between 80 and 90 majors just within that concentration every spring snapshot that comes up. So we have a high number of students. In the PR area, we have one full-time faculty, that would be me. And then it's part-time and lecturers, and then also faculty who teach classes required, but in our specifically in other areas. So I want to address that part-time issue from the part-timer's perspective, the professionalism perspective, and the student graduation perspective. And then I also want to address an issue that's very, hopefully unique to our department, but is very widespread. And that is with our full-time lecturers, with that 5-5 lecturer load or a 5-4 lecturer load. The way it actually plays out is very gendered in our department, where male full-time lecturers are able to achieve course reductions. So they're teaching sometimes a 2-2, sometimes a 1 with director of some other program responsibility, or managing of equipment and things like that. But there's a real gender inequity in how the heavy teaching load plays out, and also the stipends and the course reductions. So the part-time issue. We've all known and seen courses canceled at the very last minute for low enrollment, only 9 students. And so that part-timer's class is taken away, even a week before classes begin. That happened just this semester in our department. That's a course that those students need to graduate, that those students registered for, that they are entering, fall 2013 thinking, I've got this schedule lined up. And it was also, and this happens over and over, this is just the most recent. So those students, some of them graduating in December, some of them graduating in May, but they needed that course, and suddenly it disappears. Our part-timer who teaches that particular course, she's an excellent professional in the field of journalism and social media and PR. So she teaches essential skills for the journalism students and the public relations and others. But the straight journalism, the PR, she teaches all the InDesign, Photoshop, Adobe Photoshop, so how do you do your slick online newsletters, how do you do your nice slideshows, how do you put up a blog, the Little Rebellion, how do you put up a blog, how do you get good content on your blog, how do you search engine optimize your blog, so it's not just creating a blog, but doing it well, doing it professionally, using slideshows that are seamless for people, whether they're on a phone or in another, a pad or a laptop. So these are essential courses for students in the department. This is an essential part-time faculty member. And so she lost her salary that was gonna come in there, but the college also lost a lot. The program lost. And she is teaching another course first and will be teaching again, so thankfully we didn't lose that great part-timer, but she lost income. The students lost a course that they were already registered for, and I think that's a real issue of this last minute, we're gonna not add a class until there's overload demand or take away a class. So I think that affects graduation rate. If the administration wants to look at it, not from treating the part-timer humanely, if you look at graduation rates, it's going to hurt your graduation rates. It's going to make students very angry at the college, and rightly so. They're registered for a class and suddenly it disappears. And it also doesn't account for those transfer students and those students who are coming in the last minute who are going to go, I need that class. And all of a sudden the 8 or 9 goes up to 15 very quickly. So I think it's a ill-thought-out policy from start to finish as far as the way we treat our part-time faculty and the truly contingent employment of this week your course might be canceled. The other issue I wanted to address very quickly is the the lecture inequality, and this isn't just specific to lectures, but the workload inequality and its gendered nature within our department. Female lecturers tend to teach a 5-5 or a 5-4, 5-4 taking on advising, and male lecturers tend to teach a 2-2 or a 3-3 and take on some other administrative responsibilities and are able to get those course reductions. The females also take on those administrative responsibilities, but they don't get the course reductions or the overload pay. And so there's a real issue. Another colleague in our department has crunched the numbers. And if you look at it on gender and math, I think in general the college should be worried as far as affirmative action lawsuits, because it's a pattern that's been in place since at least the late 1990s. It's gotten worse, not better, and it's, you know, in the college's own data system. So I think that gender inequity, the heavy load for all lecturers, so 5-5 is just too heavy of a load, and then the gender.
Thank you very much.
Are there any questions for Donna? Okay, let's move on. Yvonne, do you want to be next? And then Vinny after Yvonne. Yvonne Aspengren is a former lecturer, current adjunct in the German section of Languages, Literatures, and Cultures.
I'm a former lecturer and a current, what was it? I was a lecturer for 2 years, and I've been adjuncting for about 12 years now in the language department. I had told Peter I wasn't sure if I should speak because I'm too happy, I think. I have too many good things to say. And I think I'm one of those people that Doug was talking about, that now what I'm doing fits what I want to be doing. I would like to make more money doing it. But I'm privileged. I don't have to support myself. I have a partner who makes, you know, a lot more money than I make, and I have not been the major breadwinner in my family since I was 27 years old, and I just turned 60. So I'm doing this partly because I'm privileged, which I think is a really important thing to recognize. Not everyone, not many people can afford to work in this kind of position that I do. But I also, over the last 12 years, I have found ways to make it work for me, in spite of the system. I make about 3 times as much now as I did when I started. And I always would take out my pencil and paper and figure out, okay, this week how much am I making per hour, because I spin it. The more work I do, the less I make. So the way to make more money in this job is to do less, right? So. Is that the right way? I mean, I don't tell my students that. But I have eliminated 2 exams that I used to give because they were really time consuming. As a lecturer, it's impossible to teach 5 courses. Each course has at least, in our department, at least 27 students. So 27 times 5, do the math. There's homework every single day, every single class that you have to prepare for, grade, give back. It was just, and then when they come with later on, they want letters of evaluation or letters of recommendation. It's just the more students you have, the work just multiplies. So, as an adjunct teaching 2 courses, keeping it down, same schedule every semester, I have total freedom in my department. I'm really lucky that my colleagues and my chair are so supportive. I feel kind of like I have a fully stocked basement and there's a tornado. Like, I don't want to tell you, but I have my own office. But, you know, if there was administration here, I probably wouldn't say that. And my chair has said, too, kind of keep it quiet, how good you have it. I've milked my benefits. I've taken care of my 4-person family, now down to 2 people because my kids are grown, with my benefits. I've just had a series of this, that, and the other thing. I have new contacts. I have a little carpal tunnel. I have a little heart murmur. I mean, it's all taken care of. I pay my copay, but I feel so privileged in this position. But I could lose it in a second, right? That's the thing. For me, the contingency of it. And now that I'm 60, and now that I'm taken care of, really, by my partner, I could lose it and it'd be okay. I don't know what I do exactly. I would miss it. I want to keep it, but there's no guarantee. And in August, when I was in payroll signing my contract, I was like, this can't be. I've been here 12 years. Why do I have to wait till August to sign my contract? I kind of know that I'm going to be teaching, but no, I don't know that I'm going to be teaching anytime, any year. I have a year's contract, so from semester to semester I know, but not over the summer. Been able to get unemployment insurance 2 out of 3 times I've applied, which is fantastic. But why don't we have a position that recognizes that we're going to be teaching German in the future? I've done it for 12 years. I'm probably good enough to keep doing it. Why can't I have a 3-year contract or something that reflects and values what I do? That's it.
Okay. Are there any questions for Yvonne, the happy adjunct?
And we want all our adjuncts to be happy. We want people to express joy as well as whatever other emotions they may feel. Okay, next speaker on my list. I saw Bob come in, Bob Miller. There he is. And I told you you would have the 10:30 slot, right?
Yep.
So before you, we have Vinnie Martucci from Music. Vinnie teaches piano and probably other things in the jazz studies program. He actually was my piano teacher for a few lessons until
good student.
Terrible student, but I just didn't have the time to practice enough, so I quit. I have a lot of professional musicians in my family. I'm flying off tomorrow to Chicago, where my son is a jazz guitarist, and he has a new CD release party.
Where's that going to be?
It's going to be at the Green Mill.
Ah, that's a great club.
Owned by Al Capone, the gangster, these days. So my son is one of the most successful jazz guitarists in Chicago. So it's very intimidating to be around people like Vinny or my son. So Vinny is going to talk to you about, we'll see what he's going to talk to you about. He'll improvise. I don't see any written statement, so that's good.
No, actually, these are just, first of all, I want to thank you, Peter, and it's a wonderful opportunity to have the opportunity to discuss and look at issues that are truly ongoing and have been going on for a long time. I think I'll limit my comments to 3 specific areas and just give you a little background. I've been an adjunct here for adjunct and lecturer now for 23 years, so I have a long-term perspective of it. And the other thing is, being in the music department, I just want to relay to everyone here that the music department is a type of degree program that is very heavily dependent on adjuncts. You just can't count on full-time faculty to be able to teach piccolo, flute, trombone, tuba, piano, guitar, ukulele, banjo, whatever, what have you. It's there are people that play all those instruments, but you know, they're very rare. My daughter's one of them, but. So we need people to teach a wide variety of instruments, and for a department to be viable, you have to have that flexibility in order to attract a quality student body. And so no matter what happens in the future, no matter what administration's decisions are decided or how the department proceeds in the future, one thing that will be front and center in the functioning of the department will be the fact that we will be relying on adjuncts. Lecturers, that could be a different story depending on how things go. So first I'd like to comment about the status, my 23-year status. To my point of view, this is a systemic problem that is just about impossible for the administration and the system and the country's education system at large to try and wean itself from. It's just a capitalist point of view. If you can get something done for less, they'll do it. It's just the bottom line. It's the way things work. And we have to understand that from an administrative point of view, that can be considered a successful negotiation or a successful way of dealing with things, even though there may be fallout fallout from it. That also presents, I think, an opportunity, because nobody, very few people that are here in any positions at all, as particularly if you think about the president and the provost, none of the people who are in these positions now were in these positions 23 years ago. And that we have to look at this as an institutional outcome, over a process that unfolds over time. I spent 13 years as an adjunct with the pay scale during the 1990s, and then came on as a full-time lecturer in 2005. So it, by comparison, what that does end you up with over 23 years is an ending salary compared to a tenured position person that is at a great disparity over the course of time. It's like if you take a statistics course and you watch a geometric versus an arithmetic curve, it just does this. And that's what you know, end up with. Now, for an individual, the second point I'd like to make as an individual within that, up until this past year, I've always felt, like you were saying, that there was plenty of opportunity. Although I'm questioning that a little bit right now because of I had sort of a perfect storm of or all of us did occur in the sense that DSI was discontinued. And if it's reinstatement, it's not going to be added to base. And things that went along that thing, plus the increase in health insurance and the furlough. And in my particular case, I end up now that I'm earning a significantly less amount than I was last year at this time, with the understanding that if DSI comes back, that I'm not going to be able to do what I was able to do for the previous 23 years. This is a significant change and a significant disincentive, because it isn't. I'm going to work as hard as I did anyway, because I just can't do a bad job. But the idea here is that as an adjunct and as a lecturer up until this year, I felt that I could do whatever was necessary for my students and for my family and gradually build my salary up over time. I just don't know that that's going to happen for adjuncts or the way things are at the time. The most important thing for me in terms of what needs to be done is the adjunct situation. Adjuncts, as you were saying, adjuncts really, really have a difficult situation. It's almost like a migrant worker thing, where you find out you have a job the week before you're starting. It's impossible to plan your life doing that, and I hope that that issue is front and center and addressed foremost above all others. But concurrent along these things is the systemic nature of things that I mentioned earlier, that as you go through the career path coming up as a non-tenured person, it just basically stays that way. It gets better. It's a wonderful job. I love my department. I wouldn't exchange it for anything. I really love my work, and I put in 10 times as much time and hours as is required by the job, but I certainly wouldn't have it any other way. Great. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Vinny Martucci?
Yeah, Vinny, you said that as an adjunct and as a lecturer, you felt that your salary could increase. Are you talking about through DSI
yes.
Work to base in a combination with the across the board that you were beating the cost of inflation and gradually, what did you mean?
Yes, actually that was a pretty good synopsis of it. In other words, through my efforts, it wasn't my primary reason for doing what I was doing in my department, but every year I would file for DSI and the quality of the work was almost always rewarded. I pretty much earned DSIs all the time, and they were added to base. So I significantly improved my salary status from 2005 to just this, just the past couple of years.
So more as a lecturer, you felt like when you were an adjunct, you didn't feel the DSI, because you probably weren't getting much DSI at all as an adjunct.
Right, and actually that's a significant point. That's a very significant point. As an adjunct, if you're teaching one or two courses, you're not involved enough in the machinations in the workings of the department to really be aware of what's needed. A lot of people have tremendous amounts of skills, but they can't bring them to their department because they're running to Vassar, or they're running to Williams, or they're running to Albany. So they come in and they do their thing. And they're really, I know in our department, I don't know that a lot of adjuncts actually do file for DSI. I know that I didn't because I just wasn't aware. When I came on full time, I really was brought in full. I got on the department's curriculum committee, and I was, you know, in thick with the development of new programs. And all of a sudden, I saw the bigger picture of what was going on, and it matched my skill set. And then it was possible. So for adjuncts, that really is a significant difference. We have people with major talent, but we're not drawing on it because they're not here. They're not involved enough, and in a way, they, you know, they probably shouldn't be because they're not being paid for it. You know, I mean, I'd have to think twice about that one. Yeah, that's a good, great question.
It's also harder for adjunct to apply DSI because the ones who review DSI applications are regular faculty, so they really don't have a guideline or gauge to say, okay, this guy is really deserving DSI. You know, they base their committee work and conference papers, review publications, reference publications, so on, to decide whether this faculty is DSI.
DSI is a big topic, and maybe we'll get back to it. I'm conscious of the time. DSI no longer exists, but we have DSA, which is discretionary salary awards, which are not on base. In previous years, I don't think there were ever more than two dozen out of our 200 adjuncts who ever applied for DSI, and virtually all of those who applied got it. This year, under the DSA, which is not on base, 28%, almost a third of the money, it's about $70,000, will be given to part-timers. The process is not clear. We've asked the administration many times. And I think they'll surprise us in the next week or so because it's got to be paid in the December 4th or December 18th paychecks, and they generally have to be prepared weeks in advance. So stay tuned for that. Next speaker is Bob Miller from the Communication and Media Department. I know him not so much as an instructor, but as an actor in the Mohonk stage productions that are at Unison. So. I see you now in a different role, and Bob, I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Peter. Do you want to come up here? We're recording it. And
oh, you're recording
microphone.
It. Oh.
Bob's probably not used to using a microphone, but just act normal. And
I'm nervous about being recorded. What's happening to this recording? Is that's what I'd like to know.
It will be archived on the UUP website.
Just kidding.
All obscenities will be kept.
Me and Una Merkel.
That's right.
I'm Bob Miller. I'm with the Communication and Media Department. I'm currently on a phase-out appointment and was supposed to be retiring at the end of this year, but I applied for an extension of that for one more year, and it was granted, actually. So I will be here for another year and a half. I just didn't feel it was time to retire for me personally. But I just want to talk a little bit today about my path to becoming a full-time lecturer here at New Paltz in the Communication and Media Department, which is not the department that I was trained to be in. I was a theater major at both an undergraduate and the graduate level. And when I got out of graduate school at the University of Iowa, I took a job working in colleges in theater departments. So I taught theater classes. And when I was 30 years old, I got a divorce. It was a very friendly divorce, very amicable, no children or alimony. And I decided at that time I was going to go back into the theater since I was debt-free and fancy-free and still pretty young. So I went into theater and made my living in theater for about 20 years. Then, as luck would have it, I got married again, and this time to a woman who had a couple of children, and we had a child. So I suddenly had this family We were living in Florida. I was working at a theater down there, and we decided that we wanted our children to be raised in the Northeast, where our children had the feeling that when you got old, your hair turned blue naturally, and ice came from a box in the kitchen, and that just wasn't right. So we moved into the Northeast based on a job that she got with the American Craft Council. So I came up here without a job and needed to get something, and since there was not a lot of professional theater going on in this area, I started doing what other people in my situation was doing. I started calling all the local colleges looking for adjunct work. And the first adjunct job I got was at Mount St. Mary's. I went down there for an interview. I talked about the theater department, how I wanted to teach acting and dramatic literature. And a couple of weeks before the semester started, I got a call from the head of the department saying that the nun who taught the media and society course had been transferred by the bishop. And when you're a nun and the bishop says, go over there, you go, right? You don't say, well, I can't because I... So they had nobody teach this. They asked me if I could teach it. And being raised in the theater, I said, of course, I can do that. No problem. Now, I had no more business teaching a media and society course than Fly to the Moon. But being in a position of needing the job, and this being a job that was being offered to me, I took it. So that's the first problem that you encounter as an adjunct. So you may want to teach in a certain area, or you may have expertise in certain courses, but those might not be the ones that are offered to you. So what do you do? Say, oh no, I can't, that's not really, I can't do that. No, you do it. And so I taught media and society in free fall for a couple of semesters until I kind of got that under my belt. And that ended up being one of the courses that I taught here for many years with a lot of help and support from people here. And what happened was that I gradually started getting calls from other colleges. I ended up teaching at Ulster, Mount St. Mary's, Marist, Dutchess Community College, and certainly here at New Paltz. So, and I'm sure many of you have had that experience. Take whatever jobs are being offered to you, and so you end up, running about to these different schools. You have your, books for Ulster in one bag, and your books for SUNY in another bag, and your books for Marist in another bag, and God help you if you get to the college with the wrong bag, you open it up and then you're in trouble. Nobody wants to teach a 5-5 here in one institution, but sometimes you end up teaching a 5-5 in three or four different institutions because that's what's offered. So you're not so much interested in the quality of what you're doing. The focus becomes on the quantity. How many jobs can I get? And how many can I squeeze into, a 40-hour day? Because that's what it sometimes seems like. And I taught three back-to-back public speaking courses at Ulster for a number of years. And they were just like an hour and a half, 10-minute break, an hour and a half, 10-minute break. And along about the middle of the third class, I didn't care what anybody said. There comes a point. But you don't have any choice. If you don't want to do it, somebody else will do it. And that brings up the kind of third dilemma that I faced as an adjunct, and I'm sure it was your experience too. There you are teaching a 5-5 or a 4-5 running around different campuses, and you get a call from yet another college asking if you can teach. So the dilemma is, do I really overload myself because I need the money? And the other dilemma is, if I don't take this job, they're going to call somebody else. I'm now at the top of their list for calling. But if I don't take that job, someone else is going to pop into my place. And the next time they might call that other person. They might like that other person better than me. So you have this kind of insidious thing going on where you're focused on quantity of things you can teach as opposed to quality. you're engaged in a competitive game with your colleagues, you know, actually thinking of preventing somebody from getting a job to protect that area for yourself, which is not a very collegial thing to do. And sometimes teaching things that you're not quite qualified to teach because someone offers you that position. So eventually, of course, I got I ended up here at New Paltz, being offered a full-time lectureship. You know, illustrating the point that Woody Allen's point that 80% of success is showing up. So I kept showing up here at New Paltz, and finally they had to offer me a full-time teaching job, where I've been quite happy. Like the happy adjunct who spoke before, I've liked working in the communication department. I felt very supported there. The various chairs I've worked for, several have supported me in those positions. But still, you know, you look at the pay discrepancy between what I'm doing and some other people are doing, and it's, you know, it seems unfair. I will say, though, in closing, the one very positive aspect of being an adjunct is that you don't have to go to faculty meetings. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Bob? Okay, thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
I know you have a busy schedule, as do a number of you here, so you know, feel free to come and go as you see fit. Next person on my list is Rachel Rigolino. She is a lecturer in the English department and has a lot of experience, I think, as an adjunct, working with adjuncts, working with the union as well. So, Rachel.
And I really came with nothing really prepared to say, except I grabbed this, and I know Bill will appreciate, this is kind of, you know, preaching to the choir. And I grabbed my Dorothy Day, because, you know, and I was flipping through the back of this, and of course she has a lot to say in the Catholic Worker. She's always inspired me because I'm really not very much of a radical, but I do admire her. And just flipping through, and I know that she probably, she definitely would be on our side, and whether she would say we were among the poor, her definition of poor, I'm not sure. But if you wanted to substitute poor with adjunct, I think you would get the point. And Dorothy Day, if you don't know who she is or was, she is actually a lay Catholic who is on the road for canonization, was very, very radical in terms of her politics and economic policies. So she says, yes, the poor we are always going to have, and you can substitute adjuncts, let's hope not, but anyway. Our Lord told us that that, and there will always be a need for our sharing, for stripping ourselves to help others. It will always be a lifetime job, but I am sure God did not intend that there be so many. The class structure is of our making and our consent. So I began thinking on my way over here about the consent that we all give to this structure, and I'm part of this, and I'm part of the Happy Adjuncts Lecture Club. I have an office. It has no windows. I always make a big deal. And I'm kind of like what Bob said, you don't want to draw attention to yourself. I'll say, oh, it's a terrible office. It's awful. I have no windows. Because I don't want it taken away. Like Yvonne, I'm in a more privileged place. I almost feel I have a husband and he just retired, so we're a little different in terms of income. He did say, when I said I was coming over here, he said, you know, if you screw this up, we're moving to Delaware because I can't afford to live in this state. Because he's definitely not a radical, though he suffered at the hands of the man, IBM. But who are we who consent to this? And oftentimes we are in places of privilege. We can say, all right, I'll teach a couple of classes or I can do this. But many people aren't. And I work, you know, with people who are struggling, just struggling to get by and working the 5-6 jobs. And then I wonder, you know, my department is wonderful, but why aren't there more faculty here? Because they have families, they're worried about their employment. They don't want to be seen as causing trouble. So getting back to that idea of the systemic problems. And I'm not sure what the answer will be. And I think that we need to frame it in some way to be as wise as the serpent, in a win-win situation somehow. Not always to be negative or putting people up against a wall and putting them in a corner, but say, how can we work together to make this a win-win situation? Can we bring in quantitative data that shows that if you work less, the students benefit, and that students benefit from adjuncts, so, and who are fairly paid. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Rachel?
Okay, still left on my list for this hour are Clinton Bennett and Stephanie Nystrom. Stephanie, are you here? Okay, hi. Clinton, you're next. Clinton Bennett is a member of our Contingent Concerns Committee. He's been at Labor Management. I think he wrote the minutes for the last part-time Labor Management. It's in the latest issue of the Bullhorn. So, Clinton.
Inevitably, at a forum such as this, you're ticking off what you intended to say as other people stole your lines. I saw you looking at my notes. As it happens, what I had prepared follows on from what Rachel was saying about the need for systemic change and a review of the role of adjuncts and other contingent faculty. Nationally, and President Christian refers to this in his response, the number of tenured faculty is being reduced. And although the rhetoric is to use fewer contingent faculty, in most colleges, up to 75% of the teaching is by contingent non-tenure line faculty, even though many colleges state that the policy is to employ fewer contingent faculty. And that is the stated policy here at New Paltz. On the other hand, President Christian writes, furthermore, part-time adjuncts are often hired to teach in speciality areas not represented among tenure track faculty, and often because they bring unique professional expertise and experience to the campus. And he says also that no university can deliver without employing contingent faculty. And we heard from our earlier speaker from the music department that in that department it's essential to use adjuncts because no single professor can play all of the instruments, and it would be financially impossible to employ enough full-time tenure line faculty to deliver the curriculum. However, there is a culture of denial. A culture of denial not only here on our campus, but nationally within the academy. On the one hand, adjuncts bring essential expertise, often expertise and continuing professional activity within their disciplines that is indeed unique and that almost by definition a full-time faculty member or at least a tenure-line faculty member who practiced the discipline 15 years ago or 20 years ago before they became a professor cannot bring to their teaching. And yet this unique quality, expertise, ongoing professional practice, and often, although as adjuncts were employed primarily to teach, often there is also substantial scholarly activity. The philosophy department, of which I'm a member, had an external review, and the reviewers commented that incredibly, was the word they used, incredibly Dr. Bennett is an adjunct, but he's published 12 books. That apparently is incredible. It was, though, a positive statement underlining the scholarship that I bring to my position. We need, however, I believe, systemic change to take a look, as Rachel suggested, at what is the added value, what is the added value that adjuncts bring to their teaching so that this can be appreciated. And being an adjunct should not be seen as less than the best, but as a career option that some people choose to pursue so that they can combine their professional practice, their scholarly activity, their involvement in community service with pedagogy and teaching and bringing onto the campus that unique blend of experience that the campus and the academy, Peter's moving towards me, so I guess I'm
very slowly, wasn't
it? Yeah. That it would be poorer, the academy would be poorer were it to lose the richness of that experience. But I'm not aware of solid qualitative and quantitative research that supports that proposition.
Thank you very much.
Are there any questions for Dr. Clinton Bennett? Okay. The last person this hour, and then we'll have another 5-minute break, and you can help yourself to what's left of the food back there. Stephanie Nystrom, who was an adjunct in the anthropology department, and I don't know very much about you, so you can tell us about yourself.
All right. So I'll be very quick. I'm in the anthropology department, currently unemployed, although I do have one course in the spring, so that's fairly exciting. I've been adjuncting there since 2007. This is the third institution that I have adjuncted in. Similarly to Yvonne, I am lucky in the sense that I do this job to basically pay for groceries. We have two small children, so I'm mostly taking care of them. But it was a very nice sort of job because it was very flexible. My husband's in the anthropology department as well, so we could coordinate childcare without having to pay for childcare, because once you factor in paying for childcare, working it as an adjunct doesn't really make much sense anyway. You wind up paying almost your entire salary to childcare, and it makes not much sense. So I'm fortunate in that I do kind of have this safety net, although not that fortunate because my husband works here. So it's not like he's bringing in any substantial salary anyway, which I think that the crummy pay for adjuncts is kind of indicative of the crummy pay across the entire campus. With our particular family situation, when we first moved here, we lived in a small one-bedroom apartment until our first child was 2 years old, and then we were finally able to purchase a house, but we had to buy a house in Kingston because we just could not afford to buy a house in New Paltz with the extremely high prices, high taxes, all that stuff. So I think it's very indicative and very telling that two employees of a university cannot afford to buy a home in the town where the university is located. That aside, my biggest problem, I guess, is the contingent nature of this job. That when I first started doing this, it was all under the auspices of the anthropology department, and so they could hire me every semester if they wanted to. And then I believe it was 2 years ago when they kind of threatened to get rid of all the adjuncts and kind of did for that semester and then let everybody hire them back, but placing limits for each department on how many adjuncts that they could hire. So you're faced with the situation where one semester you may have a job, but then you may not have a job for a couple of semesters, and then maybe you'll have one later on. So that makes it very difficult to try to find some other way to make up that income that you've lost. And just as a funny little anecdote from my experience, I recently took a job delivering donuts and bread for a local bakery. And I make as much money delivering donuts as I do teaching college, and I think that's pretty sad. So that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions for Stephanie?
Does she get to eat the donuts?
Yeah. Does she get to eat the donuts? What kind of donuts do you deliver?
All kinds.
Is it Dunkin' Donuts or?
No, it's Dicing's in Kingston.
Oh. Dicing's in Kingston.
I know, they're really good donuts. Okay. Really hard to work there and not.
On that upbeat, let us have 5 minutes of a break. And so we will resume again at 3 minutes after 11.